Okay, thank you. You know, we could almost end this discussion right now, because that's the answer. God doesn't like it. And when God doesn't like it, it's really equivalent of saying it's a sin. Okay? But we've got a little bit more work to do on it, because God has given us some more insights, and we need to understand those. Some of you people have been through divorces vis-a-vis your parents, vis-a-vis brothers and sisters. I doubt anyone here has been through one personally. At least none that I know of, because I don't think any of you have been married that I know of. And that's a prerequisite for divorce. But a divorce is never easy, and it's tough. And some of the phrases you hear is, well, everybody's doing it, the kids will adjust. The husband comes walking in and says, I didn't mean to hurt you, but I found someone else. The wife just dies. Or the husband comes home and the wife left him a note and said, I'm gone. Hope this doesn't upset you. I mean, I'm being a little bit tongue-in-cheek here. It just can't happen. It just absolutely tears a relationship apart. In the passage we read in Genesis chapter 2, it says, when God says, I want you two to become one flesh, and a divorce in the eyes of God, and emotionally and spiritually, a divorce is nothing less traumatic than if they put a rope around your feet and a rope around your shoulders, tied one rope to a horse, the other rope to a horse, and sent them in other directions, and just tore you apart. That's literally the ripping of the one flesh that divorce is all about. Has God ever allowed divorce? Yes. When did he do that, John? You remember? Okay. Okay. We're going to turn back and look at a passage in Deuteronomy. But Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, you can turn to that and then I'll comment on it. Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4. Before I read those passages, I think you need to understand the context of them. And Jesus, when we turn over to Matthew, tells us a little bit about these. This was something God allowed, but it was never something He wanted, never something He encouraged, and never something that pleased Him. Okay? There have been occasionally through the annals of time, especially in the Old Testament, where God allowed things. I mentioned one of them to you, I think, the other day, and that was polygamy. God never wanted a man to have more than one wife at a time, or a husband or a wife to have more than one husband. That's probably a little bit chauvinist, and I don't really understand it. It's just a cultural thing. There may have been societies where women had more than one husband, but usually it was the other way around. A husband would have more than one wife. To me, that would be just an emotionally untenable situation. But anyway, God allowed that for whatever reason. Some of the theories that men have proposed on polygamy is He allowed it so the earth could get populated more quickly. I don't know if that's the reason or not. He just doesn't tell us. This is another one. He says that He allowed divorce. And when we turn over to Matthew, the 19th chapter, in a little bit, don't turn yet, Jesus says He did it because of your sinfulness and because of the hardness of your heart. But let's read what He says here in Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4, because He does give some guidelines that allowed the children of Israel, under certain circumstances, to get a divorce. When a man hath taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes, because he hath found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement, and give it in her hand, and send her out of the house. A Lee paraphrase of that is if the husband gets tired of the wife, let him write down, we're divorced, give her the piece of paper, and kick her out. Verse 2, and when she has departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. For she was free then to remarry. And if the latter husband hate her, her new husband, husband number 2, and he kicks her out, or divorce her, and give it to her, and sendeth her out, and then if he dies, that took her to be his wife, the second husband, then her first husband, which kicked her out, may not take her again to be his wife. After that she is defiled. For that is abomination before the Lord, and thou shalt not cause the land to sin, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. It seems to me kind of obvious, and if you're tracking on this, the woman really kind of got the short end of this whole deal back there. You know, you got men divorcing women and kicking them out, and if they're not happy with them. The New Testament does an awful lot, probably does more than any single document to instill the equality of men. You know, the New Testament, not only when it's talking about the sexes, it says joint heirs, equal inheritance of spiritual things. But it wasn't always that way. Okay, that's not totally germane to divorce, but it is to some extent. But up in verse 1, there's a couple of phrases that the Jews really chewed on. It says that he can divorce her if she finds no favor in his eyes because he hath found some uncleanness. What would an uncleanness be? Or what could an uncleanness be? What might be some of the things that a guy could have divorced his wife for back in the Old Testament? Any idea? Okay, fornication or sexual immorality might have been an uncleanness. Anything else might have been? Drunkenness? Yeah, I guess the women could get drunk back then. Fifth? I'm sorry? What's that? Okay, causing a fuss. I'm gonna see if I can't get a sexual riot going down here in a minute. The men on this side and the women on that side. That's the way the Old Testament was to some extent. Well, the point I'm trying to make is the rabbis really didn't know for sure what uncleanness was, or at least they acted like it. So you got two schools of thought in the Jewish culture. One of them belonged to what was called the school of Hillel. I don't know if any of you have heard of the school of Hillel. You know what their position was on this? Any of you that have heard of them? Okay. They believed that this term uncleanness meant anything. I mean, if you burnt the biscuits, or the house was messy, or supper was cold, that was uncleanness. And if a guy got tired of her because his supper was late, he just wrote a divorce and off it went. There was another school. It was called the school of Shammai. And they were much stricter. And they interpreted this phrase, uncleanness, to simply mean sexual immorality, which I think everybody would agree that would probably classify. Okay? And I bring this up because there's this conflict and this struggle. And you can remember which was which because Shammai starts with an S, and that stands for strict. So they were the ones that were strict. They said it had to be sexual immorality. The school of Hillel said it can be anything. You know, and once you get down to defining uncleanness as a messy house or rumpled clothes or burnt food, anybody could really divorce anybody because no one's perfect. And that's what transpired. Okay, let's turn over now to Matthew chapter 19 and take a look at what Jesus said. Now, remember these two schools, the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel. Jesus doesn't refer to them directly, but when we read these passages, you can begin to see why the Pharisees ask him this question. And beginning in verse number 3, it says, "The Pharisees came unto him," that's Jesus, "tempting him." They weren't really looking for information. They were trying to figure out some way to cause a ruckus. Now, the Pharisees knew full well there was these two groups of the Jews, the Hillels and the Shammais. So they figured, let's ask him a question, and no matter which way he answers it, he's going to get somebody mad at him. And if you're trying to stir it up, that's the kind of questions you like to ask. You know, if you got a room full of people and half of them are Hawkeyes and the other half are Jayhawks or whatever combination, all you got to do is start talking about which school is obviously better, and we all know Indiana's best, so it really is a mute point. Okay, but I just picked a couple of junior colleges because you're familiar with them. Okay, but see, it works. See, I proved my point, and I was just getting started. Okay. But see, if you want to try to stir the pot up, that's the kind of question you ask. And that's exactly what these Pharisees did. They said, we're going to get him in a position where no matter what he says, he's going to get somebody mad at him. And that's what they were trying to do. But they ask him this question, and let's read what his answer is. His answer is down through verse 9. And starting with verse 4, or verse 3, "The Pharisees came unto him, tempting him, and saying unto him, Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife?" Put away in the King James simply means divorce. "Divorce his wife for every cause." That would be the school of Hillel. "And he answered and said unto them, have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Verse 5 is quoting what? Okay, you remember where that's found? 24, great. Genesis 2:24. That's what he's quoting there. Therefore, verse 6, they are no more twain or two, but they're one flesh. Therefore, what therefore God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. And they said unto him, well, if that's the case, I added that, why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? He's saying, well, if that's the position you're taking, how come Moses allowed people to get divorced? And then in verse 9, which is really the doctrinal statement of this passage from a theological standpoint, I say unto you, now remember, when Jesus said, I say unto you, that's God speaking. That's just not me talking down here or you talking. That's an authoritative statement. But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away or divorce his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whoso marrieth her which is put away doth commit adultery. And that's really the primary doctrinal statement that Jesus makes on divorce. Now, a similar statement is recorded, or this similar event is recorded in Mark chapter 10. If you want to read that at your leisure, it says virtually the same thing, except in Mark, it does give one added concept. This just talks about the man divorcing the woman, but in Mark, it tells us that Christ also said that the woman would have the right to divorce the man. So it's not just a one-sided scenario at this point. And Luke chapter 16, I think around verse 18 or so, also makes a similar comment. But since they're very similar to this, I thought I'd just dwell on the concept here in Matthew chapter 19, because the others simply reinforce that. But two of the things that Christ did is, number one, he reinforced the permanency of marriage, but he did give the concept of divorce consideration, but he gave it consideration only in one case. That was the case of adultery. Now, if I understand this passage right, what that means is when two people are married, they're married for life, and the only thing that can break that bond is if one of the two marriage partners is sexually unfaithful to the other. Now, if one of the two partners is sexually unfaithful, that does not mean at all they have to get a divorce. He says it's allowed. But we need to keep in mind that divorce is never God's first choice, or he wouldn't have said, as Jeremy pointed out, or I think someone pointed out, in Malachi chapter 2 and verse 16, that God hates divorce. Well, if he hates divorce, he wouldn't be telling you, I want to get a divorce. God's primary purpose is always reconciliation. And if you don't take anything out of this class, take that word reconciliation out. No matter what happens in your marriage, God's preference is for you and your mate to reconcile. Now, God is simply acknowledging the fact that there may be situations where reconciliation is impossible, because it takes two people to reconcile. One person can't reconcile when there's two people involved. So there may arise situations where there's sexual unfaithfulness and there can't be a reconciliation. And in those cases, he's giving the innocent party the right to move on and join into another relationship with their lives. But, again, if you get yourself in a situation where you've committed sexual unfaithfulness to your mate, the best thing for you to do is to, one, repent, and then try to reconcile yourself. Now, it's easy for me to set up here and say, reconcile, reconcile, reconcile. I don't know how I would feel if I was faced with that. But I do know that that's what God would want me to do, if at all possible. And it's been done. And many times, a stupid, foolish, thoughtless sin early in the marriage has been forgiven, reconciliation, and the couple has been able to go on to a stronger, happier, greater marriage. Not tear that union apart, tear the family apart. So, this is a case where divorce is permitted, as I understand the scriptures. But again, it's not the first choice. You're down to choice B or C if you get that far. Now, this is going to sound kind of hard and kind of callous, but I don't know how to read the scriptures anyway, and I'm receptive to thoughts you guys might have, but I can't find in the scripture really any other reason that God would accept a divorce and then a subsequent remarriage. And that opens up lots of peripheral areas. What do you do if you're a wife and you're being battered? Or a husband that gets battered? We don't hear that much about it, but it happens. You know, you'll see a very passive man, and when they go home, it's hard telling. And sometimes the wife's even physically stronger than the man. But even if she's not, and you can be abused in lots of ways other than physically. You can be sexually abused, you can be mentally abused, you can be verbally abused, and you can make that list as long as you want. So what should you do in a situation like that? There's been no sexual unfaithfulness, Ben. Okay. That's an option. I just wanted to write these passages up here before I forgot it. Okay. You could be separated from them. Okay. That might be the answer. Okay. There aren't any good options, in my opinion. I think that's a scriptural option, the one Ben gave. But when you start thinking through the ramifications, let's take a person, they're in their mid-20s, and they say, okay, I can't take it anymore, we're going to be separated. Well, that sounds all good because you're not going to get beat up or abused anymore, but that has some real strong sexual implications. Because there you've got a young man or a young woman who's still very young, maybe still would like to have a family, now being separated from their mate, not in a position to remarry, and essentially, if they want to have, you know, kids and stuff, it gets to be a hard, hard thing. Allison. Good. Okay, I have an opinion on that, but I'll open that one up for a couple of minutes. She's referring, if I understand her right, to things like artificial insemination or test tube babies, or I guess that might be a little bit. Now they're not synonymous; they're similar. Ben. Okay, Ben saying that would not look good. John?
I guess I was doing
Okay. That's charity. Okay, she's taken it a step further and kind of blasted single parenthood a little bit. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think that's what I heard you say. Okay, Jeremy? Okay. Jeremy contends that's unnatural, therefore probably not a Christian thing to do. Anybody else want to make a comment on that? Okay, I would have a problem with it, and for some of the reasons you people have said. But if I go back to Genesis, one of the purposes of marriage is procreation, and I don't find any other thing in the Bible that sanctifies procreation. That's number one. And it seems to me like the union to form the zygote, to form a new person, that person, as I think Charity said, needs to, if at all possible, have that father. And if you're talking about artificial insemination, which is an impregnation, of the woman, then I think that would be, as Jeremy said, an unnatural form of sex that God would have a problem with. Another problem I have with it is when you get into test tube babies, if I understand the process right, they take a whole bunch of eggs and a whole bunch of sperm, throw them together, and there may be 100 of them that join together, and then they'll just take one of those. Well, in my beliefs, the others that have joined together are living organisms that they've killed, and it's really a form of mass abortion, is my opinion of that. And it's the killing of 99 young single or four or six cell people just to pull one out. So I couldn't do it, and I think the scripture would support that. Do you have another opinion or a follow-up question, or you just got good questions? Yeah. And it's so, in my opinion, it's really so unnecessary. Let's say you decide to stay single and you want to be involved with a child. There are ways you can do that through either official or unofficial programs. All the way from the Big Brother, Big Sister program to now they will allow single parents to adopt. Okay, now we could discuss the wisdom of trying to raise a child in a single parent, but I don't think you have the sexual implications to get over in that case. You may have some moral and ethical things to worry about. Single parenting is not unscriptural. I'd be a little cautious about doing it on purpose. That might be a little bit unscriptural. If you're a single, if your husband's killed, you have to raise your family, you're a single parent, wasn't by choice. There's nothing at all wrong with that. In fact, it's a noble thing. It's a tough thing, I would think, because most parents find out they get tired when two of them are chasing kids. And single parents have a lot of respect on my part, if it's through circumstances that they couldn't control. Good question. Any other questions or comments on this whole general area? Yeah, Rochelle. Okay, that's a good question. I can't speak from direct experience, and I hope I never can. I have some thoughts. Donald, excuse me. Nobody in the world like it. Okay. These are on this. This is on this. Okay, William. Yeah, under the old law, it was even more strict than that. If a woman's husband died, not only was she to remarry, but who her husband was going to be was laid out. It was her husband's brother's job, and then it just went down the list. So you could conceivably, under that scenario, be locked in with someone you really didn't like, which would be kind of stressful to us today. Jeremy, did you have a point on that? Different or less? Well, one of the great fallacies, I believe, of the romantic society that we're engaged in is that there's only one person for you. I mean, that's a joke. I mean, that means if the right person for me happened to be born in Florida, I'd probably never get married. you should feel that way about the person you marry. But for instance, I told you I met my wife at one of these 2-week meetings. Well, if I hadn't come to that 2-week meeting, would I have never found someone that I, or would she have never found someone she could love? Well, the answer to that is probably no. Okay. I think you can definitely love more than one person, especially after there's a little passage of time and the healing of the hurt. I mean, don't go marrying on rebounds, whether it's someone broke up with you or a death. It's just common sense to have some passage of time. I think it's perfectly possible to love your second mate more than your first. But I think Jeremy's phraseology is different. Every relationship is different. And so it may not be more or less, but it can be different. And I really encourage people that are young and lose their mates after a normal period of healing to reconsider it, because let's say you're 35 and you lose your mate. You don't have to remarry, but that's a long time and that's a lot of evenings of loneliness, so don't just shut your mind to it. Would I remarry if something happened to my wife? I have no idea. My first impulse is to say no, I wouldn't, because that's such a private and a personal and an intimate relationship. But on a little more thoughtfulness, after a few years, I can see that. I would definitely want her to remarry, because I wouldn't want her to have to live for maybe 40, 50 years and be lonesome. Now, the Bible, I believe, in 1 Corinthians 7, does give us some indications that definitely when you move into your second marriage, you should do that in the Lord. There's a lady here whose husband was killed when she was fairly young, and she never did remarry, raised 4 kids. And I have a great amount of admiration for her, but I know there must have been lonely nights when if she could have found the right one, it might have been nice for her. But that's her decision, not mine. And she's just a jewel of a lady, just a prince of a lady. One of the reasons, you know, for me, the whole thought process of going back through that dating process is, I mean, I'm glad you guys are doing it. I'm glad you guys are doing it. Because I'm, but you just don't know till you're there. Allison? That'd be kind of foolish. I'm not sure I'd go as strong as to say sinful. Marriage is such... You've got to understand how permanent God sees marriage. I mean, if you really understand how cemented together God views two people, then to do it without really thinking through all the aspects of it, it just becomes so ultimately foolish. And to marry just because you're lonesome, that's a terrible reason to get married. That's one of the great benefits of being married is companionship. But to get married because you're lonesome is a wrong mistake. To get married because you want kids, dumb. It's great to have kids. Terrible reason to get married. You got to marry because you have a love relationship with that person. Then all these other things, companionship, procreation, they all flow out of that. People have kids to keep the family together. Wrong reason. As soon as the kids are grown, there's nothing to hold that family together. That's why you see people get divorced when they're 40, 50 years old. John. I think you're right. That's easy to say, but it doesn't make it a wrong thing to say it. It makes it right if we can put our lives. And that's why it's so important to have two mates in a marriage, two pillars in the family that have the same values as much as possible. And we talked a little bit about, I think Tom may have talked about marrying in the church, so I won't beat that horse again. But that, you know, the reality of it is sometimes people get married and they may wake up in a year and say, I'm not sure we're in love. But if they're committed to making the marriage work, then I think love can grow. Because love is so much different than lust. And when you're young, and even when you're my age, sometimes it's very hard to separate those two. But try to separate the two. physical attraction is important to a marriage relationship, but if that's all they got, as soon as that physical attraction starts to fade, the marriage is in trouble. And you just see that time and time and time again. That person you marry may be in an automobile accident in 6 months and may be in a wheelchair for the rest of their life. What are you going to do then if it's just a physical attraction you guys have? Those are hard things. They're things you don't want to consider, but they happen every day. That's why it's so beautiful to see a relationship where you know it's rooted in so much more than the physical. Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Well, I might make a comment. Here in Matthew 19, this word for fornication, I think I mentioned it Tuesday, is the Greek word porneia. And it doesn't mean just adultery. It could include all that whole list I had up there Tuesday. Incest, homosexuality, lesbianism, bestiality. Surely that doesn't happen too much anymore, but if it can happen, it happens. Okay. But it's any kind of relationship outside of marriage, and that does free the person. But freedom, being allowed to do it, doesn't mean you're in a position where you have to do it. Try to reconcile. Okay, let's turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Paul talks a little bit about this also. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. There are several passages in the Bible that refer to this, but if you remember Matthew 19 and 1 Corinthians 7, you've got 90% of the teaching on marriage and remarriage and divorce. Okay, let's find the right place here. Well, let's look at verse 1. Now concerning things which you wrote me of. In other words, these people had asked Paul some questions. And apparently one of the questions they've asked is, should we get married or should we not get married? And Paul says in verse 1, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. That's another way of saying it's good if you don't get married. Okay? Now Paul's not commanding him not to get married. And we know that for several reasons. Number one, he tells us that here. But when he gives qualifications for elders and deacons, what's one of the qualifications? Be the husband of one wife. Well, Paul, who wrote that, wouldn't say nobody should get married, because then he's saying we should have no elders and deacons. So it's just an illogical statement. But he is saying something very important here. And look over at verse 32. About halfway through that verse, it starts out, he that is unmarried careth for the things that belong to the world, how he may please the Lord. But he that is married careth for things that are of the world, and how he may please his wife. There is a difference also between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman careth for the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and in spirit. But she that is married careth for the things of the world, how she may please her husband. Paul is saying it's very good if you can abstain from marriage because you're going to have more time to serve the Lord. He also in this chapter says, I understand most of you aren't going to be able to abstain from marriage, and rather than committing the sin of fornication, it's much better for you to get married. Paul apparently was not married when he was an apostle. We really don't know whether he was ever married or not. My personal opinion is he probably was in younger life. Whether his wife died or left him when he turned into a Christian, we're just not given any insight, and I can't prove it. But most Jewish people studying to be a rabbi would have been married, because that was a prerequisite of being a rabbi, and it appears that Paul was on the fast track in the Jewish system. But be that as it may, he's saying it's great to stay single if you can, but I understand most of you can't, so don't sin. Go ahead and get married. Jeremy? Well, I think that phrase, it's not good for man to be alone, means a couple of things. I think God's saying for most men, it's not good. They need that companionship. But I think you can be single and not alone, not in a marriage relationship. But I think that passage. See, when he said that, it was just Adam, and I don't know who Adam was going to talk to, the trees or the cows or the horses. And so I think that phrase probably includes more than marriage. It also includes friendship. And it is not good for us to be a hermit. Okay, most of us need the relationship with a member of the opposite sex. But there are some people, otherwise Paul would have needed to have gone and gotten married again if he felt that was a commandment of God. Okay. And when you are single, I think it's a greater temptation. Fornication is a greater temptation when you're single. Now, today, society says stay single and fornicate, and that takes the place of marriage. Well, obviously, that's not a Christian principle. It's an American principle. You know, why get married? I was visiting with a couple in last two Sundays ago. I was at a congregation in northern Missouri. They had a German foreign exchange student live with them for 2 years, and they took her to an American wedding, and this girl was about 20. And she could not for the life of her understand why these people were getting married. And this Christian couple tried to explain to her that before they lived together, they needed to be married. She said, why? And they just went round and round. In Germany, most people, she said, don't get married, and at a minimum, they don't do it till they've lived together for 5 to 10 years. And, you know, their children are their flower kids. They're at their wedding. It's about as non-Christian a concept. But America's moving that direction. We're just a little bit behind them. And she was being very sincere. She just could not understand why in the world this couple was getting married. Why not just live together? And I wish we were further from that than we are, but we're not. We really aren't. Okay. Anybody? Okay. There's one other possible reason for divorce that I believe is found here in chapter 7. And I'll just highlight it. Verse 13. It says, and the woman which hath a husband that believeth not, and if he's pleased to dwell with her, let him leave not. This is saying if you're a woman, you're married to a non-Christian, and he's satisfied with that, and is willing to stay your husband, stick with him. Okay, but if you look down in verse 15, but if the unbelieving party depart, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. I believe Paul is telling the Corinthians, at least, that if you're married to a non-Christian and he can't accept your Christianity and wants to leave, let him go. Okay? That's the only way I know to interpret that way bound. Okay? Now, let me preface this by saying that doesn't mean go out and marry a non-Christian, because then you're free to divorce anytime you want to, because he puts a real stipulation on this at the end of the chapter. But go ahead, Brad. You got to talk a little louder. I believe he's saying, in this case, to the Corinthians, if the unbeliever leaves, then the Christian party is then no longer bound to that relationship. It's not okay for the Christian to divorce the non-Christian. The only reason I'm hedging just a little bit, I think this may have been a little bit of a special system there, because people were married, and then one of the parties might have joined the church, and the other one might have kicked them out. This may have been what happened to Paul. Paul became a Christian, his wife couldn't accept it, and so she left him. I don't know. But he says in the end of this chapter, in any scenario, your second marriage, make sure it's in the Lord. I think that's plain. Okay, you guys can't get them much higher. Jeremy, you were first, but I don't care who talks. My understanding of this, and I'll take you over to verse number 39, is my understanding of that is she would be free to marry, but only to marry another Christian. It says in the Lord, only in the Lord. The very end of verse 39. Okay, in verse 11, we're not talking about an unbelieving relationship yet. We're talking about two Christians. And it's saying if there's two Christians and they separate for grounds other than fornication, then they're not free to remarry. In verse 13, he changes and starts talking about a relationship where one of the partners is not a Christian. That's why marriage is so serious. If you get into a marriage thing, as I understand the Scriptures, You've got no right to remarry unless, one, your mate dies, or two, there's sexual unfaithfulness on the part of your mate. And that's, you're going to hear all kinds of scenarios and all kinds of rationalization. And if you can find, if you can show me in the scripture, I'll listen. But it's that, it's, and we're talking about the negative side of this. Let's also talk about how wonderful it is to keep it together. You know, don't enter a marriage thinking, how am I going to get out of this if it doesn't work? Because if you enter it that way, it won't work. Because there's, it's just like a job. There's times if you could afford it, you'd probably quit. It's a good thing most of us are poor. That's why we don't quit. Well, if you enter into a marriage thinking this is permanent and it can't fail, and both parties feel that way, then when there's little tiffs and tuffs and misunderstandings, they just keep coming. My grandmother used to say, you know, there didn't used to be divorces because you were out on the farm and you couldn't get to anywhere else and you had to work together, so you had to work it out. If you got that mindset, you can work it out. John. Yes. Okay. My interpretation of it is in the first part of verse 15, when it says depart, that means he no longer wants to be married to her. What you said is absolutely true, but I think the phrase here, depart, means leave. Jeremy. I'm not trying to make it easier to get a divorce. Boy, don't believe me that. I just pointed this one out. Maybe I shouldn't have brought it up. No, I should have. It's in here. You need to study it for yourself. Yes. If this doesn't mean what I think it means, you would be. But I think this frees her from that. In that case. I'll be here tomorrow. You can come back at me tomorrow. Yeah, do. Okay. But this is the exception. Okay, this is really, really an exception. Okay, a real exception. Anybody else have a question? Okay. Remember, the overriding thing is marriage is permanent, and except for sexual unfaithfulness, you're bound to that person. And even in sexual unfaithfulness, divorce is not God's preferred way. Reconciliation is the way that God wants it to be handled. And if everybody would remember that, then we could just shut down the divorce courts. People are always looking for that better mate, that better marriage, or the perfect sex. What they end up doing is they just take their problems with them. There was a story I was reading, and it was about a marriage counselor. I wouldn't be able to make a living as a marriage counselor, by the way, because most people don't want to hear what... And a Christian, I don't think, would have a hard time making a living as a marriage counselor, because this is not what the world wants to hear. This guy goes into a marriage counselor, and the guy says, "What's wrong with your marriage?" He said, "Well, it's my wife. She does this, this, this." And he asks him a few more questions, and the guy says, "Well, you're here to change your wife, then." He says, "Yes, that's why I'm here." You don't change your mate, you change yourself. A lot of people get married thinking once we're married we'll change, that person will change. Very seldom does that happen. About the only person you can bank on is changing yourself. And oftentimes that's not. very successful effort. Okay, I was going to talk a little bit about honoring your parents, but we've got 5 minutes, so I'm not really going to jump into that. Does anybody have any questions or comments on anything we've talked about while I've been down here the whole 5 sessions? Okay, let me make just a couple of brief comments on honoring your parents. Ephesians 6 tells us to honor our parents. I think you've all got a good grasp on what that means when you're living with them at home. Doing it's one thing, but I think you intellectually understand it. Let me just make the comment that as your parents get older and you move away, you still have a responsibility to honor.